this, I try to take a break around every 90 minutes. And with that said, is there any suggestions for changes to the agenda or additions? None? Okay. We'll move into reports on recent activities. I'm going to hold my comments to the end. I don't believe Paul. Paul, do you have anything? No. So that puts us right into the regional administrator. Whenever you're ready, Pat.
Okay. Good morning. Thank you. Let's see. Atlantic Herring, effective October 25th. We closed Area 1A for landings more than 2,000 pounds, and that'll be effective through December 31st. We projected that we reached 90% of the TAC for that area. Atlantic scallops, the proposed rule for Framework 20 to maintain the interim Atlantic sea scallop measures for the elephant trunk area published in the Federal Register on October 30th. The public comment period on that closes on November 4th. Closed on November 4th. Sorry. Framework 20 would maintain the interim measures that we enacted, that NIMS enacted in June to reduce the potential for overfishing of the scallop resource in the elephant trunk area and to also to deal with the deck loading issue. On October 15th, we received a petition for rulemaking from the Northwest Atlantic Marine Alliance and the Midcoast Fishermen's Association requesting that the Secretary of Commerce promulgate emergency regulations to prohibit midwater trawling in areas close to ground fishing. That petition is under review at this time. We wanted to let the council know that we had published a proposed rule in the Federal Register on October 15th in response to your request to implement gear standards for the eastern U.S. Canada haddock SAP and for trawl gear in the regular B Days at Sea program. The comment period on that proposed rule closes on November 14th. On October 20th, we reopened the eastern U.S.-Canada area, including opening of the eastern U.S.-Canada haddock SAP through the month of November with a 1,000-pound trip limit for Georges Bank cod. That was because we determined that I think approximately 20, just over 20% of the Georges Bank cod TAC was still remaining after our closure earlier in the year. And finally, the final rule amending the regulations for the Atlantic Large Whale Take Reduction Plan published in the Federal Register on October 5th. The changes will affect gillnet and trap pot fisheries, including several fisheries that have not been included. Among other requirements, there are broad-based gear modifications in specific times and areas that will replace the seasonal area management and dynamic area management programs that currently exist. And that's all I have, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Thanks, Pat. Questions for Pat? Dr. Pierce.
Pat, do you have any update as to where the service stands with the revision to the National Standard Number 1 guidelines?
They're under internal review right now. The last time I asked, the response I got was we hope that they will be released shortly. Realistically, I think it'll be January.
Anyone else? Any questions for Pat? Okay. Thanks, Pat. NOAA General Counsel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Really nothing to report. There's been no progress, really, in either of the lawsuits that involve this council, one brought by Massachusetts and New Hampshire regarding Framework 42, and then the lawsuit brought by private vessel owners regarding Amendment 1 to Herring. We are scheduled to have a scheduling conference for briefing and so forth in the Herring lawsuit this month. But other than that, I have nothing else to report.
Any questions for Gene? Okay. Fisheries Science Center.
Thank you. I'll give an update on first the ships and then go into stock assessment meetings. The autumn bottom trawl survey was conducted with the Albatross. It was completed on October the 31st. Some extra stations, random stations, were added offshore southeastern Georges Bank and detected some concentrations of yellowtail flounder. During the cruise, they also encountered two large 4,000 to 7,000-pound toes of haddock, primarily the 03 year class, but other year classes were also mixed in. And they encountered high densities of dogfish in Massachusetts Bay and western Gulf of Maine. You can see Dave's going to need to change his shirt after this. The calibration, the Bigelow, the new vessel, has had significant mechanical issues with the propulsion system, and this has limited it to generating only 14 paired toes on leg one of the autumn bottom trawl survey. So it's significantly behind in the work that was planned. The Bigelow has been unable to fish since September the 12th due to these mechanical problems and is expected to be back online around November the 8th. The discussions about the impacts of these losses on what will be done to modify the calibration efforts will be delayed until after the end of the field season, which is in mid-November. So that's when the survey group will talk in earnest about how to adjust ship plans. Regarding the Herring Acoustics cruise with the Delaware, the survey was conducted from October 12th to 26th. It only got 15 days in out of a planned 35 sea days. And again, this was due to some mechanical issues with the Delaware, which delayed it from starting. But nevertheless, even though it was conducted during the latter part of October, they did encounter concentrations of spawning herring in the survey area. Moving on to stock assessment issues, we are preparing for the striped bass SARC, which will be SARC 46 at the end of this month in Woods Hole. We just completed the first of the preliminary meetings for the GARM, and this was the data methods meeting, and it took place in Woods Hole October the 29th to November the 2nd. And it covered a broad suite of issues related to the data that will be used in the GARM assessments. That's the 19 groundfish stocks. The next meeting for the GARM, the next of these preliminary meetings, will be the models meeting, which will be February the 25th to the 29th, also in Woods Hole. And that concludes my report. I'll take questions.
Jim, where did you say those dogfish were? Any questions for Jim?
You said they were in Massachusetts Bay and western Gulf of Maine.
Okay, thanks. Dr. Pierce.
Yeah, Jim, you indicated that the Bigelow had significant propulsion problems. Just a question regarding the nature of those problems. I know that when the Bigelow first came on board, Senate representatives indicated that there was some, I think, significant propulsion problems, and they were hopeful that they would be corrected. Now, are these the same problems, or is this something different?
I don't know the details, Dave. I think it's been the propulsion system all along, but I don't know more than that.
Okay, thank you. And you indicated that 15 out of 35 days were accomplished with the Delaware, with the herring survey, acoustic survey. Now, I know that last time around, maybe it was last year, there was some concern that the timing was off, that the research vessel was not on the grounds when the fish were there, therefore the acoustic data, the biomass estimates, whatever was provided, really weren't representative of what was there because of the mismatch. You indicated that spawning herring were encountered. Are you in a position at this time to say that the timing was right, so we'll be able to use that information, or is it too soon for you to even say anything about that?
No, that's too soon for me to tell. What I told you is basically what I know, and we'd have to speak with the people who analyze the data to answer your question.
Okay, if you would, then, just that I would appreciate, as with all the Pelagic Committee members, certainly this full council, just appreciate some insight as to whether or not the timing was on, because if it's on, then great, we'll have something we can use. If the timing is off, then I guess if the timing is off, then, you know, why bother to look at the information, because it won't be useful.
Dave Gaethel.
My question for Jim is how is the acoustic survey ground truth? How do you know that you're looking at heron and not dogfish, as an example?
Again, that's a question that the people that do the acoustics would have to answer. But I think that they do a number of ground truthing studies looking at the acoustics of targets, and then based on those preliminary studies, they use those to figure out what they catch during an acoustic survey.
But they don't actually take a sample. I mean, they're not operating with a midwater or a bottom trawl or something to verify that, you know, what we see is what we get.
I don't know the answer to that. I suspect that they do some ground truthing, but I'm not sure. I can check.
Okay. I'd appreciate it if you would. Thank you.
Anyone else for Jim? Okay. Harriet?
I don't know. Harriet Diedrichson, Port of New Bedford. I own a scallop vessel. Scallop vessel, and I also a proprietor of a ship channeler in New Bedford. I'm just wondering, it was brought up, I don't know if this is the appropriate time, at the New Hampshire meeting, we were talking about the surveys and so forth on the Bigelow and the comparisons, and at that time I asked if the fishermen, captains who had been on the advisory panel, if they were going to be in an ongoing way aboard the survey boats when they were out doing these surveys, so that they could still be looking at the gear and see if it's working the way they thought it would and so forth. Is this happening? Is this going to happen? Or what's been going on?
Yeah, the work that was done in July was with the trawl survey advisory panel on board. The paired tows that were done between the Bigelow and the Albatross used the gear that was the latest that was recommended at the end of the July cruise, which members of the Trawl Survey Advisory Panel were instrumental in picking that gear. And since the ship has been not at sea since that time, there's nothing else to report there. But we intend to continue to use the Trawl Survey Advisory Panel to get advice on gear as more data are collected, because the new gear that has been adopted in July hasn't been tested very much yet, so we're not really sure. It looks like it performs well, but we need to collect more data to really understand how good it is.
My basic question is, are the captains going to be aboard the vessel when the surveys are done? That's the question, to be out there when the work is being done so they can see it on site. Is that a yes or a no on that?
I'd have to check. I think that people are welcome on the ship, and the advisory panel was on the ship the last time it was out sampling. and we don't intend to change that. So you may be looking for a yes or no answer, but it's a little bit more complicated.
And if the Bigelow is not going to be working or it's going to have problems, how do you plan to do the surveys at the proper times of year? Are you going to go to fishing vessels, which personally I always think the work's done best on fishing vessels, and the person who designed the Bigelow happened to testify against me under oath, and he said he knows nothing about fishing, and he never represented himself as such. So when I heard this vessel, I'm sure it's good for some things, but as far as doing research for fishing, I question it, and I've questioned it right along, and I feel that if fishing captains of the particular species you're out doing the research on are not on the vessels, I really feel it's a major problem, because they've been fishing, they know the areas, they know what to expect, and therefore I think they would foresee problems in the catch where perhaps the scientists wouldn't. So from industry, this is where it starts. This is the standard in court, the science, and I would expect this to be done with the best care, because here's where it starts. And if it's garbage in, it's garbage out. And this is a lot of families up and down the East Coast. They're all depending on how this work is done. This is what is giving them their livelihood. And I think here's where the attention has to be done. I read about the Bigelow and National Fishermen, and the problems have started, and the research has to be done. Their fishing boats can do it. And I feel the industry captains have to be involved, or I don't think it's going to work. I don't think you're going to get good figures, and I don't think you're going to have the really have confidence from industry. And that's what I heard. We're going to get a new boat. We're going to help you, when the trawl problem was discussed in Gloucester for 3 days. This is what we're expecting, and it looks like it's off to a rocky start. Thank you.
Nancy Thompson.
Yeah, thanks, John. I'm not going to give a yes or no answer either. What I am going to say is that we have a process and a plan, and we are following that plan as far as the calibration is concerned. We are also following the plan in terms of the recommendations that have been made relative to the gear. We are also working very hard to improve, shall we say, communication with the advisory panel, and we will continue to communicate with the advisory panel relative to the calibration and the calibration trials. As far as the breakdown is concerned, we're very much aware that what we need to do is a full calibration cycle, and that is calibrate it against the full year cycle as far as the bottom trawl surveys are concerned. So, yes, we are, in fact, working with the NOAA Corps and within our own agency to ensure that once the Bigelow is up and running, that we will be able to calibrate it against the A4 for a full year cycle.
Thank you. Anyone else from the council? Bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Philip Rule, Fisherman Morale. I have some comments about the trawl survey. And basically in response to a letter that came out of the Senate last week addressed to the Mid-Atlantic Council, but it was circulated to the Trawl Survey Advisory Panel. The question is, do you want it just the appropriate place and time, John, or do you want to do it later on?
I think I was just handed the letter this morning. I haven't had a chance to look at it. I know I've spoken to Rodney, spoken to your brother, and I hear what Harriet's saying. I heard Dr. Weinberg and Nancy Thompson. It, just to be perfectly blunt, it sounds like there's a breakdown in understanding between the survey, the trawl survey panel, and perhaps the center. And rather than get into a protracted you said this but did that discussion, I don't think the council is equipped with the facts either on either side to make a determination as to what is happening. But I am concerned that something may be happening. We have members from our council, members from the Mid-Atlantic Council as well, that sit on this advisory panel. You've all done a good job of keeping us informed. What I sense right now is that you're coming to us and telling us, based on what I've heard today and conversations I've had leading up to today, you're telling us that there's something going on that we need to know about. We don't have the letter. The council hasn't had the benefit of having the letter or having the opportunity to review the letter. So I would respectfully request, rather than you go through point by point on the letter, a rebuttal of that letter, that we schedule a time where I can sit down with members of the Trawl Survey Advisory Panel, figure out what your concerns are, and I'll also work with the center to figure out what their perceptions are of your concerns. And then we're in a better position to have a discussion in February on that situation. That's my recommendation. This isn't an attempt to sweep anything under the rug. It's an attempt to put the council in a position where it can make decisions based on the information. Nothing more. Phil.
Well, I can appreciate that, John. So I request that if you, under open period, I prepared comments and rebuttal to the letter. The letter could be circulated to the council by tomorrow with no problem. And I'd be glad to come back for the open period. I think it's tomorrow.
Today we have an opportunity for public comment at 1:15 after lunch.
All right. I'll stick around and put it in then if you don't mind.
Thanks, Phil. Anything else for Dr. Weinberg? Okay. We're on to Mid-Atlantic Fishery Management Council liaison.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The Mid-Atlantic Council met in mid-October in North Carolina. They approved the document to take to public hearing for Amendment 10 to mackerel, squid, and butterfish. The purpose of this amendment is to develop a mortality cap for the Lalago squid fishery, adjust the minimum cod-end mesh size to reduce discards of butterfish and other targeted species, or non-targeted, excuse me, while eliminating some of the exemptions for the ELEX fishery vessels, and establishing seasonal gear restrictions, GRAs, for reducing discards of butterfish. So this will be going out to public hearing. Jimmy Rule pointed out there were some problems with the way the mesh was measured with the observer program. It was pointed out that this was in the document, and the Mid-Atlantic Council agreed to send a letter to look into how the mesh was being measured on board or not being measured on board by the observers. Dogfish Committee met, and the Council reviewed the committee recommendations. And after that, they recommended an 8 million pound spiny dogfish fishery split into two periods, and a 600 pound trip limit was approved in 1 year specifications. The council's chairman, Pete Jensen, and Dr. Eugene Craig will continue as chair and vice chair. And following a presentation on monkfish, the council agreed to notify the New England Council and supports its intentions to develop a framework to the monkfish FMP. That was basically about it, unless Jimmy has anything to add.
Thank you. Questions? From the council. Seeing none, any in the audience? Thank you. All right, we will move on to Coast Guard. Captain.
Thank you, Rip. This is our first report since the August meeting. There were six lives saved. From our point of view, life rafts, immersion suits, and e-perbs continue to be the leading equipment that assists us in saving lives. We worked with 17 injury cases over the period. 15 were just due to illness, bad food, bad hearts, things like that occurring out on the fleet. Two were actually attributed to onboard accidents, dislocated shoulder, and someone got stung by a skate. Let's see. Regrettably, there was one death that occurred. It was a 65-year-old lobsterman who went missing October 27th up in the vicinity of Little Deer Island, Maine. His lobster boat was found aground with the clutch engaged and the engine running and no one aboard. Local lobstermen assisted us in the search by pulling his gear to see, ensure that he wasn't entangled in it. But regrettably, even after our searches and all the great local cooperation that we had, he remains unlocated. There was one vessel sinking, the F.E. Jacob Allen, that sank about 35 miles east of Nantucket. Thankfully, all six crew members were safely recovered by a good sand vessel that was nearby. Interestingly, the Jacob Allen had an Nymphis observer on board the boat, and I'd just like to relay some of the observer's comments regarding fishing vessel safety training that she was required to go to. I quote, "Thanks to my previous survival training, I knew just what to do in this emergency situation. Although the events were happening quickly, and I was very nervous at first, I took a deep breath and just started following the steps that I had learned in my training class. I remembered to wear layers where the knife and flares were located once inside the raft. I reminded everyone to drink water to treat shock and prevent overheating in our cramped, steamy little life raft. I taught everyone how to shoot the flares, and I even remembered to keep making jokes. Let me tell you, if you have to do a survival situation at sea, that's exactly the kind of person you want to be doing it with, somebody who's trained, somebody who's going to pass their training on to others, and God bless her, somebody who keeps a sense of humor in that situation. So I just can't say enough about the safety training. Pat, I want to compliment NIMS for requiring your observers to go through some level of training, and here's a case where it paid off. Training aside, there was another nifty little piece of gear that this observer had with her called the personal EPIRB, and we locked onto that. We also locked onto the ship's EPIRB, but had this observer become separated from the life raft, had this observer become separated from the EPIRB, she had her own with her. We locked onto two signals, and it brought the aircraft right in on top of them. Continuing with safety, there were 200 commercial fishing vessel safety examinations conducted, and 141 decals were issued. We had 30 EPIRB activations, none except Jacob Allen, which were actual distress. Enforcement-wise, 444 commercial fishing vessel boardings were conducted. 14 fisheries violations were issued. They were all pretty minor. 13 commercial fishing vessel voyages were terminated, however, for lack of safety gear. As much as lack of a life raft, bad survival suits, no fire extinguishers, bad fire extinguishers. It's terrible to go out there and get yourselves terminated. It's a lot cheaper, I think, in the long run to just have the gear on the boats. And if you need the gear, you can't go back ashore and get it. 85 vessels were issued minor safety violations. And this summer, the First District conducted over 420 recreational fishing boat and charter boat boardings targeting striped bass in the EEZ. We issued 7 violations for folks keeping striped bass when they were in a location that wouldn't allow them to keep it. We worked a lot with our Canadian partners out along the border, our cutters getting together with their cutters, and just making sure that we're doing the best we can to continue a cooperative enforcement agreement, not only up in Maine, but all the way along the Hague Line. We have deployed and we're experimenting with a new piece of safety gear. One of our Falcons from Air Station Cape Cod, the Jets, is now flying with a 406 EPIRB direction finder. It's sort of in an experimental phase right now, although we're very, very pleased with how this piece of gear is working out. We had a case in Maine, again, a lobster boat case, where they had gone aground and they had activated the EPIRB signal. And this was just before the period of this report. But the Falcon, at 15,000 feet, was able to lock onto the signal from 72 miles away from it and fly directly to it. We're pretty excited, as you can imagine, about any piece of gear that's helping us reduce the search and rescue. We expect that the experiment with this piece of gear will conclude favorably, and we're looking, well, we'll receive money to deploy them. And we expect that by the end of 2009, every aircraft flying out of Cape Cod will have 406 EPIRB DF capability on it. So that's some good news there. And with that, that's all I have, so I'll take comments if there are any.
That's good news. I hope the experiment proves successful and you're able to deploy that on all the aircraft. Any questions for Joe? Rodney.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just have a comment to add. The captain of that boat came through our safety and survival training in New Bedford and 1 year, and the next year went back to be a drill conductor through the money NOAA provided for us to do these trainings. He is a perfect example. He does do his drills every trip. He showed me his log of the last year. He lost this year's log on the boat, but last year's log he had at home. Half of his crew went through that training. The other half went through the next training we had. They did everything right. The day prior to that sinking, they had an abandoned ship drill. So that's just to show you that if you do it right, your chances of survival are a lot better. Thank you.
Thanks, Rodney. Anyone else? Okay. Moving on to NIMS enforcement. Jim, did you want to add something to your report?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I forgot to mention one thing regarding the SCOLOP survey for 2008. We are had originally planned to use the Albatross for that survey. However, now we are uncertain about what platform we'll be using to do the survey. Thank you.
Nancy?
Yeah, I don't want to prolong this, but it was in July of 2007 that we found out that the Albatross was not going to be available for the SCOLOP survey. So my personal decision has been made, and that will use a UNOLS vessel as a substitute this year and over the short term. I'm at this point, I'm looking for the funding within my agency to support that. So just to tell you where we are relative to the SCOLOP survey in terms of being open here, that's where we are.
Okay. NIMS Enforcement.
Good morning. Andy Cohen with the NOAA Office of Law Enforcement. During the last quarter, we have seized approximately $275,000 worth of product during enforcement actions, and NOAA General Counsel issued NOVAs in the amount of $2,600,000 and change. This is, again, this is kind of a steady state. This is not out of the ordinary, but we are pretty busy. I've got a couple of cases I want to tell you about specifically. Last week, a gentleman named Steve Kudo pled guilty in U.S. District Court in Boston to making false statements and structuring cash payments. He owns a dealership in New Bedford, and what he was doing was buying overages over the past few years with cash and then not reporting that cash, which may impact the work that the council does in setting limits and accounting for what is being harvested. This was a joint investigation with the Internal Revenue Service, and the reason for that was Mr. Kudo was it's called structuring. When you deal in cash, more than $10,000, you've got to fill out what's called a currency transaction report, which is a form that was designed to prevent people from money laundering. So if you go to the bank and get $10,000 or more, you've got to fill out the currency transaction report, which just alerts the IRS to a large sum of money being transferred. What he was doing was structuring, and he was taking out amounts of about $9,999, somewhere in there, consistently, which showed a pattern, and structuring in itself is the same as non-reporting on a currency transaction report. So we got him on that. And over the past couple of years, he made approximately $774,000 in cash transactions and he struck him on 133 occasions. He'll be sentenced on January 31st. He faces up to 5 years and a $250,000 fine and probation. So if the council needs some specifics to determine how that's going to impact the fishery because of the non-reporting, give me a call and we'll get that for you. An unfortunate event occurred in Delaware where Delaware officers acting under their joint enforcement agreement with NOAA boarded a charter vessel and was assaulted by the captain of the vessel over a dispute about a dolphin or a wahoo. And he was arrested and charged in state court. We opened an investigation, but I don't think there's going to be any federal charges levied. He went to court. He was found guilty. He paid a fine, and he's on probation. Fortunately, we don't see that kind of behavior too often, but when we do, we can't tolerate it. Excuse me. When I last spoke to the council, I told you about an incident where farmed catfish from Vietnam was being imported illegally into the United States. Some of it was treated with malachite green. Much of it was mislabeled as domestic products. And as I told you, we indicted a number of companies and individuals. That is scheduled to go to trial in Los Angeles during January. Whether or not it will actually go to trial or there will be a plea, I don't know, but we are preparing for trial. And that should be a very interesting case to watch because it affects domestic seafood markets pretty much all over the country. We have been working with Canada Oceans and Fisheries on some border issues. A number of lobster traps were seized a couple of weeks ago in the undisputed Canadian area. American lobster traps, those are being kept by the Canadians. They're not going to be returned to the owners. And in the disputed area, we have not seen any real problems. I understand it's crowded up there. It's always crowded up there. Once in a while, the issue seems to flare up, but as try as we might, we don't see an epidemic of problems up there. If anyone hears otherwise and has specifics, we sure would like to know about it, and so would DFO. And we'll continue to work as partners with them. And you may have read about a whale strike that occurred with a recreational boat off Rye, New Hampshire this summer. The person was operating the vessel in a reckless manner. In fact, before he struck the whale, he was contacted by a harbor master and either cited or warned about a speed violation, went out and hit a whale on Jeffries, and a NOVA was issued for $8,500. That was a finback whale. And unfortunately for the respondent, it occurred very close to a number of whale-watching boats, and lots of pictures and video were taken, and there were a lot of witnesses. So it's kind of a poster child case for whale-watching behavior, but an important one nevertheless. Currently, our VMS population is a little bit over 1,500 boats. The majority of those units are SkyMate and Boattrax and Hutrons. And I have a procedural suggestion for the council. The VMS program is getting so complicated that perhaps as an addendum to my enforcement report, a specific VMS enforcement report be presented to the council at meetings by Bill Semro, the VMS manager. I don't think it would take a great deal of time, but Bill has a lot of specific information that I don't really have an in-depth knowledge of on a to answer the type of questions that you might be interested in. So I'd ask that you might consider that. And that concludes today's report.
Consider it considered and accepted. I think it would be great to have Bill, if he's available, come and give us a VMS report at our meetings, unless there's objection from the council. Okay.
Thank you. And one more addition on that. Bill's VMS staff answers a lot of questions for the public. And I would encourage people to continue to feel free to call our office. I guess I ought to be careful what I wish for. But we seem to get a very good response from the customer base, if you will, who calls up with questions. The staff is very knowledgeable. I'd submit that they're running out straight. They're pretty overworked. But we welcome those kind of inquiries. And we would really rather answer questions up front than issue a violation down the road. So it's a partnership, and we want to continue to operate that way.
Andy, the story you told us about the structuring, what species was that involving?
It was a variety of species, and I don't have the specifics of the case with me today.
Yeah. Okay. And I think it was the last meeting we had in September, you spoke about the late reporting, I think is what it's being called, in the herring fishery. Are there any more updates on that?
Yeah, we've been working with the herring industry to try to correct that. Several NOVAs have been issued, and I think that there are a couple more in the pipeline for late reporting.
Any questions for Andy? Anyone else? Okay. Dave?
Andy, reading these reports every couple months, you see some of the same names kind of over and over and over. Some of it's how they work their way through the system. The NOVA is issued, and then later on there's a settlement or whatever. But do you get a sense that we have a kind of a small population of people who can't get it right, that need to be dealt with in a different way than the current system deals with them? Or do you think it's that maybe these people just get more attention once they get their first violation?
Well, we do treat repeat violators differently. We being the enforcement group, which includes the agents and general counsel, and the penalty schedule has a sliding scale, and repeat offenders are faced with higher penalties than first-time offenders. Do they get increased attention? I'd say sometimes if it's warranted. We pick and choose our targets, and we pick and choose the targets that may be productive. To answer your first question, do I see a lot of repeat offenders? Well, I don't know what a lot is, but we do see repeat offenders. They're dealt with on a different level than accidental offenders or first-time offenders in concert with the penalty schedule, which is a published schedule. It's not arbitrary.
I think what I'm a little bit concerned with is there's some people that fining them or whatever just doesn't have any effect on. If you have no money, you can't get blood out of a turnip. And I'm just wondering if we have some people that just stay in the system because we have no other means of removing them from the system. In other words, when fining them doesn't get their attention, when permit sanctions don't get their attention, they just go fishing anyway. How do we deal with that type of an individual who basically operates outside the law?
Well, I don't see a lot of people operating when faced with a permit sanction. Usually, and this is a generalization, if somebody's put out of the fishery by a general counsel, they are out of business. That seems to be an effective way. If it's something that needs to be done immediately and can't go through the NOVA process, general counsel can ask for an interim action, which puts them out of the fishery immediately until the case is resolved. We don't do that very often because it's a pretty high standard that we have to meet to do that, obviously, because there are less checks and balances with an interim action than there is with a real resolution. If your question is about sending people to prison for fisheries violations, we've done that in some extreme cases. Most of these regulations under Magnuson are civil violations. That does not include a fine. It includes a penalty, and there's a difference between a criminal fine and a civil penalty. and a criminal conviction may result in jail time or probation. And sometimes that's appropriate. I would submit that it's usually not appropriate in fisheries-related cases, but as in the case of Mr. Kudo, it was appropriate. And as the case with the catfish, we decided that the criminal remedy was more appropriate than the civil. And when we make that determination, we do it together with general counsel, and we do it together with the Justice Department. And the three entities figure out what the best result will be, and then we pursue it that way. However, no matter how many times somebody comes in with an overage of scallops, Congress has spoken very clearly, and it's we can all have our opinions on that, but that's not a criminal violation.
Andy, still a little confused about this Mr. Crudo case. What fishery was this case? What fishery were there overages? And if there are overages, there's a vessel supposedly landed overages. He bought them and didn't report them. So, and it's not in this case here, right? So how can we be concerned about the overages that are underreported if we don't know what fishery it was involved in?
Paul, I don't have that information with me, but I'll get it for you. All I have is a press release that was handed to me yesterday. So I don't know what the specific fisheries were. What I'm saying is, given the volume, it may affect council actions, so I'll follow up with that for you.
Anyone else for Andy? Okay. Anything Atlantic States? Terry?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. The Atlantic States Commission held their annual meeting last week in Annapolis, and of interest to this council, there are two issues. The first was the herring section voted to lower the Area 1A TAC to 45,000 tons, consistent with this council's plan. And the herring section also voted to task a technical committee to analyze the efficacies of the spawning area closures. It's going to be a big deal for the commission, and I'm hoping that it will have some good discussion with our projects committee. The second issue is the Spiny Dogfish Board voted to set the 2008-09 quota at 8 million pounds, with 58% of the quota being allocated to the states from Maine through Connecticut and 42% from New York to North Carolina. And this will be with a trip limit of up to 3,000 pounds per day, state waters only.
Thank you, Terry. Also, Paul Howard and I traveled to the annual meeting in Annapolis. We were there for Sunday evening and Monday. We left on Tuesday just as an opportunity to mingle a little bit with the Interstate Compact and the members of this council and members of other states as well. And we were there for the herring discussion and the dogfish discussion as well. Interesting to watch how a different process works. Dr. Pierce.
Thank you for coming.
Yeah, just a couple of other items that relate to the ASMFC meeting. Again, glad you were there, both of you, to share the experiences, some of the pain. With regard to sharks, ASMFC did spend a great deal of time focusing on the coastal sharks. For quite a long time, ASMFC has been working with the federal government to develop a coastal shark management plan that would also include smooth dogfish. And they did agree to a document that is, it's a draft FMP for coastal sharks, and it will go out to public comment fairly soon. And one other item that I believe is included in a document that was adopted by ASMFC, specifically by the River Herring and Shad Management Board, is the draft plan. Actually, it's Amendment 2 to the Interstate FMP for Shad and River Herring, and a number of recommendations, options, that is, in this draft that relate to stopping directed fisheries on river herring, on shad. But the one that's, I think, especially relevant to this council, and it will come up, I suspect, in discussions either today or tomorrow, are for recommendations for actions in federal waters. I think this is still in the document. If it has been taken out, then please, anybody who was there, correct me. But it says specifically in the document that's going out to public hearing, specifically the commission recommends that the federal government implement measures to quantify river herring bycatch by federally managed fisheries and reduce river herring bycatch within those fisheries. And what's notable here is that, you know, the spotlight is on herring as well as mackerel. It's not just a herring issue. It's a mackerel fishery issue as well. So, you know, it's in the document, if for no other reason than to call attention to the fact that, you know, data are required. We need to have a better understanding as to, you know, the nature of the bycatch of those of river herring specifically in those important pelagic fisheries. And a couple of other issues, but they're minor, so I'll just pass over them.
It's David. Terry.
Yeah, thank you, David, for talking about the river herring. There is a public information document that was approved last week, and it will be going on for a public hearing in December and January with a preliminary action at the February commission meeting to draft the amendment.
Anything else on Atlantic States? Okay. We'll move into monkfish. Take a 10-minute break and we'll be settled in for monkfish.